The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
From the Book of Serenity, Case 18, Zhao Zhou's dog. The pointer. A gourd floating on the water. Push it down and it turns. A jewel in the sunlight. It has no definite shape. It cannot be attained by mindlessness, nor known by mindfulness. Immeasurably great people are turned about in the stream of words. Is there anyone who can escape? The main case. Student asks Master Zhao Zhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Zhao Zhou said, yes. The student said, since it has, why is it then in this skin bag? Zhao Zhou said, because it knows, yet deliberately transgresses. Another student asked Zhao Zhou, does the dog have Buddha nature or not? And Zhao Zhou said, no. The student said, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Why does the dog have none? Zhao Zhou said, because it still has impulsive consciousness. Hongzhi's verse. A dog's Buddha nature exists. A dog's Buddha nature does not exist. A straight hook basically seeks fish who turn away from life, chasing the air, pursuing fragrance, cloud and water travelers. In noise and confusion, they make excuses and explanations. Making an even presentation, he throws the shop wide open. Don't blame him for not being careful in the beginning. Pointing out the flaw, he takes away the jewel. The king of Qin didn't know Liang Zhongru. Who let the dog out? So on Wednesday, I took up this koan as it shows up in the Gateless Gate. So this is a good example of how here we have two dialogues, full dialogues with Zhao Zhou, beginning with this basic question of, does a dog have Buddha nature? Zhao Zhou responds differently in each case, and then there's further. But in the Gateless Gate, and other teachers as well, I don't think Wu Min necessarily initiated that, but they just took the very first part, does a dog have Buddha nature? Zhao Zhou said, no, mu. And so there, because of that, it becomes a very particular question and a very particular koan. That's why in koan lineages of koan training, the way we do it here, mu is often typically the first koan, because the first koan is very special in a way, because it's a wilderness for the student. It's a complete uncharted terrain, in a sense that student has never really engaged in this kind of study before, in this kind of meditation. And so what that first koan is very particular. Hakuin's sound of one hand, what is the sound of one hand, was also used. What is your original face, the face you had before your parents were born? So some of these were used as first koans to basically bring the student insight into their self-nature. And mu, I think part of, because it's so powerful, was sort of very often is that. But here we have this more extended dialogue, which really changes the whole nature of the dialogue, because it doesn't just end with Zhao Zhou saying no, but it goes further. And so I thought this was an interesting opportunity to look at how, you know, I spoke the other day about in Buddhism this challenge, let's say, of what the Buddha was enlightened to as being unnameable, ungraspable, ineffable. So we speak of a mystic path as that beyond what can just be grasped with our senses or known with our thinking mind. And so we have to, in a sense, employ different ways. When we're in school and we're learning about different subjects and different fields, we use our mind in a particular way. We develop particular skills. Here, because it's not in the realm of knowledge, ultimately, we have to develop different skills, which is all basically present within our consciousness and our mind. And so a gourd floating on the water, push it down and it turns. Here's an example of an analogy or simile of something that, you know, we can imagine, we can see, we've seen it happen. And so it's an image to present a way of being. Push it down and it just rolls over and pops right back up. So it's a way of expressing something, trying to convey an image, something, an experience of something that is not about a gourd, but is that about a possibility that we possess. That a jewel in the sunlight, when it's really in the radiant sunlight, its shape is not so well defined. Right? It begins to lose its definite boundaries. He says it cannot be attained by mindlessness or known by mindfulness, as important as mindfulness is. Immeasurably great people are turned around in the stream of words. You know, we see it's become just a part of our culture that people with a lot of power use words to turn other people around, to influence, to deceive, to manipulate, to control. But when they themselves are the subject of words, they don't like that. Which means they themselves are also being controlled and manipulated and influenced. Is there anyone who can escape? That's one of the real powers of koans, is it's using language to free ourselves within language. Because language and consciousness are so inextricable. Right? I mean, can we think about just that's already showing you. Can we think about living without thinking? Right? We can't even think about it without thinking. Right? Can we even imagine being in the world and experiencing things without language, without a narrative, without a way of describing and naming? It's so deeply embedded in us. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Xiao Zhou says no. And the student asks the obvious question, well, wait a minute, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Why does this dog have none? I want to today just focus on the second part. Tomorrow I'll focus on the first part. And Xiao Zhou says, because it still has impulsive consciousness. Does that mean you and I have no Buddha nature? But that's a fundamental teaching. That's what the Buddha was enlightened to. The Buddha basically laid that question to rest. It's not a question in Buddhism. It's not debated. We can doubt it about ourselves. But Buddhism is, the Buddha made that very clear. That's what he was enlightened to. And yet Xiao Zhou says no. I imagine this student is concerned at this point. Because is the student really concerned about the dog? And so taking up this koan, then for the student, what is happening to the student right now, right at this moment? Do they have Buddha nature? Do they have impulsive consciousness? I mentioned Da Wei the other day. And in one of his letters, he wrote letters to a lot of students. He had a lot of lay students. And it's interesting because in that, you get a window into how his lay students, some of them were, seemed like a lot of them were ministers and officials, people in, you know, government and so on. So he said, you inform me that you respond, as you respond to circumstances in your daily involvement with differentiated objects, you're never not in the Buddha Dharma. You also say that amidst your daily activities and conduct, you use the saying, a dog has no Buddha nature, to clear away emotional defilements. If you make efforts like this, I'm afraid you'll never attain enlightened entry. Examine what's under your feet. Where do differentiated objects arise from? How can you smash emotional defilements in the midst of your activities with the saying, a dog has Buddha nature? Who is it who can know he's they're clearing away emotional defilements? The discriminating mind that differentiates objects. He's asking this student to examine not so much the object, but the mind that differentiates, that discriminates. And when he asks, how can you smash emotional defilements in the midst of your activities by bringing this koan to mind, is he saying, that's what you can do with this koan? You can free yourself of emotional defilements? Or is he saying, be careful not to try and extinguish emotional defilements with this koan? We can use a koan, we can use our concentration as a way not to gain insight into emotional defilements, but to push them aside. And sincerely believe that we're doing our zazen. I'm here, I'm trying to be mindful, I'm trying to concentrate. This emotion is getting in the way, so I push it aside so that I can maintain my concentration. But that's deciding that that emotional defilement, that emotion, is a problem in and of itself. And it needs to be extinguished. It needs to be avoided, denied. The Buddha was clear about this. Certainly in the Mahayana, this is very clear. And yet at the same time, to just be entangled in it is not practice either. In the commentary, it said, this student might have thought that they were judging the result on the basis of the cause. And I was interpreting Zhao Zhou's response on the basis of his question. But if you understand in this way, you cannot even be the servant of a professor. Apologies to all the professors who are sort of standing in for people who are caught in intellectual attachment. Professors, scholars, they oftentimes take a hit in the literature. But we appreciate them. Particularly Buddhist scholars. And the commentary also says, the point of this student's question was to broaden their perspective in learning. They didn't base it on their own fundamental endowment. They wanted to broaden their perspective in learning. In other words, to gain more understanding, to confirm what they already believed, that all dogs, all beings have Buddha nature. Didn't base it, the question, on their own fundamental endowment. In other words, wasn't coming from and wasn't trying to clarify their fundamental nature, but was just trying to have an interesting dialogue. So, Zhao Zhou says a dog does not have Buddha nature because it still has impulsive consciousness. So what is impulsive consciousness? So in Buddhism, beginning with the Buddha and establishing these basic teachings, these afflictive emotions, we call them kleshas, greed, anger, and delusion, are very often the principles which you can see relate directly to grasping, aversion, and neutral. Are three basic impulses. But those impulses, from the very beginning of our lives, we have built in, right? It's part of our physiology. We experience pain, we experience pleasure, and we experience sort of a neutral state. And so we have those experiences. And as we come more into consciousness, we misinterpret our experiences to begin to develop a sense of a self that is separate from everything else. And that begins to become established as a sort of, as a view, as an assumption, as a belief. Not even a belief, I believe in this, but it's just an embedded view of things, right? It's not something we consciously are doing. And as we keep having experiences that are painful or pleasurable in particular, and then responding to those. So we respond to pleasure with some form of grasping, we want more, we respond to pain with aversion, deny, ignore, numb. Those experiences repeat themselves over and over and over. in all kinds of situations, in relation to all kinds of encounters. And that, the Buddha said, is the formation of what we call these afflictive emotions, where they become dominant, the dominant influences within our deeper consciousness. A Sangha Indian master said that they are a kind of phenomena which upon its arising, arises with the characteristic of being thoroughly disturbing. So the nature of these kleshas, they're always pointing to what we call negative emotions. Negative in the sense that they cause suffering, they arise from suffering, they strengthen that sense of a separate self, they lead to actions which are not helpful, that cause more suffering, samsara. And so that their characteristic is to disturb upon its arising our mind stream. And that the mind stream then becomes thoroughly disturbed with thoughts, right? And that the six ways these afflictions cause this disturbance is they distract us. They distract us from what's actually happening. They distort, they skew our sense of what's actually happening. We can't see clearly because the emotion is so, has so filled our consciousness. They create excitation, which is not like being enthusiastic, but it's being agitated, right? It's a very unstable state. They also can lead to a state of dullness. Oftentimes one follows the other. They lead to a kind of carelessness. When we're in a very strong state of emotion, oftentimes we're careless. We're not careful with what we say, with what we do. They lead to a diminishment of restraint, right? That in a different state of mind, more stable, we might have an impulse to say something, but we wouldn't. We might be inclined to do something, but we don't. And so we lose that sense of that healthy sense of restraint. And that they can affect the mind by, I talked a little bit the other day about latent tendencies. So these repetitive actions in Buddhism's understanding of consciousness is that each of those actions is like a seed that gets planted in our deepest consciousness and that we're not aware of, but they're there and they build up and they build up and they become more fertile. So the analogy of a garden. That's when I quoted Bill Waldron, he said, our behavioral patterns are informed and driven. So when we react, we're both reacting out of these afflictive emotions, but at the same moment, we're also strengthening them. So there's a kind of positive feedback loop, positive, not in a positive way, positive in the sense of strengthening. And these tendencies, which are ever ready to trigger our habitual reactions. And that's why the Sanskrit term means to follow along, to be led by, to dwell on. And so you can think of these as our sort of built-in bias or our proclivity, our inclination, our tendency to respond to things in a predictable way. I remember meeting years ago with a group of young students in a school in the city. Their counselor was a student. And these were students who, as I was sitting talking with them, had grown up hard, had very difficult lives, had seen things no young person should see. And one of them was very, I was there to talk about meditation, one of them was very kind of impenetrable, not having any of it. And at one point he talked about how, you know, he's in charge of everything, he's in control, and his best friend said, no, you aren't. And he said, yes, I am. He said, I can get you angry in a second. It was amazing. I want to say, would you like to please take the class to his friend? And the other way that they exist is through what's called manifest tendencies. So they manifest. And they manifest by internally disturbing. So that's all of our restlessness, our agitation, this energy that is, you know, roiling. You know, that's why it's so important, as difficult as sometimes it is, to sit in this discipline. Discipline here means a good thing, an intention of stillness, so that we can actually experience that internal disturbance and not be distracted, and begin to learn how to settle it. Because when we're distracted, we make it stronger. And so there's internal disturbance. It obstructs our engagement with virtuous activity. So when these afflictions arise, it makes it very hard to practice well, to live well, when we turn against the precepts, when we turn against our basic good nature, right? It's almost always because we're, you know, in a sense, being motivated, being led by some strong emotions. In the same way, it motivates us to act and create negative karma. It encourages us to hold on to what's harmful, and it creates conditions for future suffering. So these kleshas are central to Buddhist practice. The Buddha said there is no liberation without liberating the kleshas. In fact, they're basically the same. And so greed, anger, and delusion are the sort of principles, the big three. And there are different collections, but pride, jealousy, are also included. So I wanted to talk about these a little bit. And this, you know, in terms of working with this koan, would not be anything that the student would want to bring into Dokusan, right? This is explaining, talking about, just drawing from Zhao Zhou's response, impulsive consciousness. The koan is trying to go to the heart of the matter. But for a Buddhist practitioner, understanding this would be important. So for this student, who's in the story is a monastic, they would know when Zhao Zhou said, because it still has impulsive consciousness, what that means. And that would be informing them in terms of what happens next. So think of the kleshas as like an unwanted guest, right? So you've prepared a meal, you bring it to the table. You know, it's not the kind of guest that just shows up right when you're getting ready to eat and says, no, I'm not hungry. What'd you make? Right? No, they just show up. They don't knock. They don't ask to come in. You sit down to have your nice meal, minding your own business. Maybe you're reading a book. Maybe you're watching the news. Maybe you're talking to your parent, your child, your partner, a neighbor. Minding your own business. They don't know that you have this unwanted guest. They don't see it. You might not either. But then the person you're sharing the meal with says something, and your unwanted guest says, did you just hear that? What the? Who do they think they are? Anger, right? Now you don't see the guest, there's just anger. And the unwanted guest is pointing directly at your neighbor, at your mother, at your child, at your partner. They did this to you. You should get angry. Or they are remarking on some good quality that you have or some accomplishment. And your unwanted guest says, oh, you are the best, man. Nobody really appreciates you for who you are. You are so better than all of these others. Why are you wasting your time with them? Or they offer a little criticism. Right? Not good. Or they take too much of the food that you prepared and put it on their plate, and they say, you're not going to have enough, right? Or they say, do you know how much this person makes? They make a lot of money. They have a whole bunch of cars. They don't really need all of those cars. Why don't you get in good with them and maybe you can get one of those? And even when we begin to realize this unwanted guest is kind of annoying, right? They just show up. You didn't ask them to show up. And then at some point they leave, and when they leave, you realize they've broken dishes, they've thrown food against the wall. They never clean up after themselves. They live a mess. They don't even say goodbye. And so you're ready for them to not show up, but they keep showing up. They keep showing up. And you think, why do they keep showing up? And then when you think about it, you realize, well, I actually invited them here again and again and again. I did. I kept inviting them. And even when they, you know, say something nasty or they get me all riled up, it's kind of fun, right? Yeah, they leave a mess, but there's something good going on. So it takes a lot to have them go away or just be there and be peaceful. So attachment, I spoke of earlier, functions to give rise to suffering. One of the important things about Buddhism is it's very, very carefully examined these different mental and emotional states. And in Buddhism, they're not really differentiated. We tend to think of thoughts as thought objects and emotions as an emotional state. We have different words, but in Buddhism, they're pretty much the same. So talking about a thought has an emotional quality and vice versa. So attachment's function is to give rise to suffering. So when we attach, there will be dissatisfaction and disappointment. That's its function. And it's said that in seeking an object of our desire and pursuing it, we become weary. It's tiring. It's exhausting. If we fail to obtain it, then we're tormented by that failure. If we succeed, then the weariness of having to work so hard to get this and then watch it pass away, fade away, because it's impermanent, is even more exhausting. And then we feel sorry and have thoughts about how it used to be. It used to be so fine. What happened? So much energy. I mean, I think that's what we see in intensive practice. Is not that intensive practice is so demanding, but that the kleshas are so demanding. They exhaust our energies, right? And one of the things about the rigors of Sesshin is it's harder and harder to keep them up, keep feeding them, right? Because we don't have that much energy to spare, right? Because the schedule is challenging you. And so it can help us to relinquish. Anger is to feel hostility, right? It's described as it functions as a basis for unhappiness. It's the basis of our unhappiness. Arising as intolerance, hostility, wishing to cause harm. The teachings say there's nobody who lives happily with anger. They cannot exist at the same time, which is a very strong statement. They cannot exist at the same time. So in a sense, we have to choose. That one of the effects of anger is that it leaves no space for joy. It takes up all that space. And that it also sets us up for harmful actions. We know that. Pride is a grandiose mind. It's not the same as feeling satisfaction, you know, a sense of fulfillment by having accomplished something. That's natural. That can be good, healthy, like feeling good about having done Sesshin, even if it was challenging, right? Feeling like you have done something that was worthwhile. You gave your heart to it. You practiced sincerely. It may not have gone entirely as you would have liked, but there's a feeling of satisfaction. That's healthy. The grandiose mind is not. As a klesha, it functions as the basis for being disrespectful. Very interesting. That when we're prideful, we become disrespectful of others and perhaps to ourselves. An inflation of the mind. And it always involves comparison with another. I was thinking as I was working on this, I was thinking about being in an orchestra. You know, so every musician in an orchestra has spent years and years and years developing their artistry, developing their instrument, right? And they're part of a group. So if they try to rise above, I want everybody to hear me, right? then they take themselves out, right? That pride, that self, ruins the music, right? Now, there are moments where they're asked to step forward and play a solo. But that's because it's part of the whole piece, right? And then as soon as that solo is over, what happens? Then they step back and, in a sense, disappear. But they don't disappear, they merge. It also recognizes that there's a pride of inferiority, which is a national favorite, we could say, a cultural favorite. And it's not a person's fault when we have a strong inclination towards a feeling of being self-critical, self-disparaging. It's part of our culture to manufacture that, to create that, to strengthen that, to sustain that. But to see it as a klesha, to see it as an afflictive emotion. Ignorance is one of the kleshas, a mental factor that engages in its object in a confused manner. We engage in things, people, situations, emotions, thoughts, objects, but in a confused way. It's not clear. And of course, ignorance is the basis of the other mental afflictions. Because of being in a confused state, the other, it sort of sets the stage, it sort of rationalizes the other afflictive emotions. I remember being on the train when I was at the temple coming back on Metro North, and there were four or five guys, friends, who got on, and they all sat in single seats. They didn't sit together. But then they carried on a conversation the whole time, which was loud, right? And one of them was talking about something that somebody had said to them. And it was a long conversation. He said, I deserve to be angry, don't I? Don't I deserve to be angry? Yeah, man, you deserve to be angry. Congratulations. Afflictive doubt, I spoke about the other day. An afflictive view is related to ignorance, but it's really the specific view of self. Seeing things in terms of me, in terms of mine, what is my possession, what I identify with, what I don't identify with, is spoken of as an exaggerated sense of me that arises from the depths of our heart. When someone praises us, when someone criticizes us, we feel inflated, we feel deflated. And so the teachings are that we need to understand these so that when they arise, we can recognize them and not see them as some sort of aberration, some particular problem of yours, right? Like, what's wrong with you? But rather a universal experience of human beings that is a part of mind and consciousness that is created. We create them, right? Unknowingly, we don't, you know, as soon as we start thinking, we don't think, okay, which of the afflictions do I want to really make strong, right? It's not a conscious, like every habit we create, we don't recognize when something becomes a habit. And so in a certain sense, they're not our fault, even though we've been actively involved in creating them and strengthening them, and then identifying with them. I am an angry person. I am not an angry person. I am better than the rest. I am way behind everybody else. And the repetitiveness of that is what strengthens it. And when we really understand that, I think it's much easier to be kind and compassionate to ourselves when we are struggling, right? To release, to relinquish, to not get caught, to not be deceived, to not believe. It's just a voice. It's just a story. It's something that we have been told. And at some point, we became the storyteller. We took it on. And just to recognize it as that, and that everybody's going through that. So when you're sitting here and thinking, why am I the only one who's struggling? you can know that that is not true. And that what you're struggling with has your particular scent on it, right? Your particular flavor based on your karma. But the ingredients are the same. They're universal. Anger, greed, pride, jealousy. So how do we keep from getting turned around? From getting seduced? That's what we've been doing all week. That's what you've been doing. Every time you can see what's happening and not get pulled in and eventually let go of that grasping, or getting pulled in and at some point recognize that and then releasing your grasping. It's shifting because the repetitive action of strengthening the kleshas is being interrupted. If we keep responding the same way, then that repetition just keeps happening and it just gets stronger. In other words, you draw from your fundamental endowment. You're drawing from your intention, your aspiration, your faith in yourself, which is connected, is arising out of your Buddha nature. When we begin to see how much of this precious human life we devote, and in quite a devoted way, to our own unhappiness, it's alarming. It's unsettling. And it should be, right? It should get our attention. This isn't something that's happening to us. Yes, we are the recipient of many, many influences, for sure. And some of those, maybe a lot of those, have not been helpful. And to recognize that is important, is helpful. So we don't personalize so much. But once something arrives at our doorstep, in our consciousness, once it is in my mind, it's now my responsibility. Even if it arrived unfairly, it shouldn't have arrived, but it did. Once it's in my domain, it's in my mind, I will respond to it. I will think about it. I will speak about it. I will act on it. I will strengthen. That's how it started. That's how the klesha started. I will continue to strengthen that, or I won't. And that's why it's important we talk about ceaseless practice. It's not just ceaseless mindfulness, although it's important to be practicing, but it's ceaseless in trying to see and be aware of all of those moments where in a sense, we're on a pivot. Something's arising, we're responding, there's an emotion, and there's a pivot. Do I turn back and go the same way? Do I relinquish, release? When we see honestly and nakedly and simply, and that's, isn't that the wonderful hard part of this? Right? When we see how our grasping functions to give rise to our suffering. And the thing is, when it arises within us, try as we might, we can't contain it. We can't restrict it. We can't create a boundary and say, okay, I'm creating my own suffering, but I'm not going to give you any of this. I am. I'm going to give some of it to you. Not wanting to do that is the Bodhisattva vow. Taking responsibility for when I do that is atonement and practice. When I see how my anger functions as the basis for my own unhappiness, how I will never live happily as long as I keep sort of enshrining, honoring, empowering my anger, how my pride functions as a basis for my being disrespectful, how my afflictive doubt functions as a basis for not engaging and the things that are going to help me. All beings have Buddha nature, don't they? Xiaozhou says no, because they still have impulsive consciousness. So does that mean we have to extinguish, eliminate, eradicate our impulsive consciousness before we can realize ourselves? The footnote to that says no, it's never been removed. But a nature has never been removed. Zhao Zhou says, no, it's not absent. Then why does he say no? Impulsive consciousness has never been removed. And yet we can free ourselves of it. It's never been removed because it's not something. It's not something that we can take and put somewhere. It's not something that is in the moment when we're under the influence of it. That's what ultimately we need to see. It is not something. And it has power. And so that power, when all of the effort that we put into grasping, clinging, into just tension, right? Into these very strong emotions. I mean, think about what happens when you go for a ride with some very strong emotions. Afterwards, how do you feel? Usually we're exhausted. We're exhausted. And sometimes that's a kind of a washed clean, you know, if we're practicing, it's just showing us how much energy that takes. When that begins to calm, all of that energy is there for you to live, to pour into, to dedicate to your vows, to your commitment, to your intention, to living in wisdom and compassion. As I said earlier, it's difficult when we experience things that are painful to not see them as a kind of enemy. It is doing something to me. That's the afflictive view. Why me? Why me? When the more we understand this, the more it's like, oh. You know, think of all the times Mara showed up to the Buddha, to the disciples of the Buddha, and it's to just... And Mara always comes as an affliction. Doubt, temptation, desire, anger. To disturb, unsettle, uproot, unseat the practitioner. And when in every one of those dialogues, when the practitioner says, oh, I see you. What they're saying is, I see my mind. I see this aspect of my mind. I am not you. You are not. I am not this, right? Myself is not in this emotion. This emotion is not myself. It's just an energy that's arising that, in a sense, has been taught to arise in that particular way. I have exercised that over and over, and now I am going to let it drop. I'm going to let that fire start to cool and burn itself out. So, it also helps us to recognize, and I'll talk more about this tomorrow, to recognize all of this in each other. How can we be compassionate towards others, particularly when some people act so badly? How? That is a full question that deserves a lifetime of inquiry and practice. But this is part of it. When we recognize within ourselves our own, you know, call them what you will, demons, bad actors, negatives, moments, Mara, then we see, we're gaining an understanding. Oh, I see my mind, I see your mind. I see your mind in this anger, in this greed, in this lack of understanding, in this lack of empathy, in this uncaring, in this hostility. In your attachments, I see your suffering. In your pride, you know, I see your inflation. It helps us, right, to not reduce a living thing, a being with Buddha nature, to an object. Because we have done the same with ourselves. And so, in these pregnant moments, hours in the last of this session, all that we've done this week is in you. It's in your mind. It's in your consciousness. Whatever your present experience of Zazen or meditation or your mind might be. And so let's really practice all the way through. Be on this seat. Be in your own practice. As Dharu used to say, give life to the Buddha.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.